own gratification. But they want to do in the Postal Service at all costs, and that's ISIS, baby.
Yes, it is.
Hammer that away. Get rid of all those local offices. No service on Saturdays. It'd be a shame.
Delivery 3 days a week, maybe two.
Yeah.
Mondays and Fridays.
Knock off about 150,000 workers or so. Union workers. Good union-paying jobs.
Right.
Son of a gun. Just to lower that game.
Yeah, and I don't want anybody to understand and misunderstand me, Andy, when I start talking about the UMWA the way I do. I am decidedly pro labor and pro union. Always have been, always will be.
Well, I've heard that president of the UMWA, he's out of there. I mean, he's totally in bed with the coal industry, and you said it on your show, and I've heard him talk, you know, outside of the horn. This guy is a nut. I mean, he is just bought and paid for by the coal industry. I don't think he has the workers anything cares a bit about them. He's all about growing the coal industry. That's it. Saving coal.
Yeah.
That's it. That's his mantra. The workers be damned. He just wants to keep the coal industry flourishing. And I'm sorry, King Coal is going out. I don't care what they do.
Well, there's less than 25 years of the stuff left in the ground here. What do these poor benighted fools think? That, I mean, do they think that the coal companies are going to throw them a party, re-educate them, give them long-term pensions, or cover their asses? You know, there's another one of those videos out there. I didn't play it on the show, of one of the coal workers' wives saying, "My little four-year-old boy, you know what? If you asked him what he wants to do, he'd say he wants to be just like his daddy."
Yeah.
Well, you know what? That little four-year-old can't be just like his daddy, because there won't be a coal industry and there won't be any coal.
Right. Retire with black young and die at age 50. Beautiful.
Just like daddy did.
Right. And then that UMW guy is doing nothing for the
Cecil Roberts. No, I know a lot of retired underground miners that to harken back to something Irish Dave mentioned. I know a lot of underground miners who are retired who wouldn't piss on Cecil Roberts to put out a fire.
Right, he's doing nothing for those people that have black lung now, which is up on the, you know, which is on the rise again because the standards and the regulations.
Oh, and by the way, in case you didn't know, Andy,
not looking out for them.
The Republican budget. Cuts, black lung, the budget line items, because, you know, who cares, right?
Right, workers are just an object, that's all. They're just an object to be used, abused, and thrown to the curb, man. Now you're done, you got black lung, you're done. You help yourself.
Yeah.
And it's like Saab Erekat said, man. You know, culture, it's not our culture. It's not the reason for the culture that we're in the situation we're in. We're under an occupation. You know, it's an occupation, just like you guys are being occupied by the coal industry, man. They're being occupied by the Israelis.
Yeah, this is an occupation.
An occupation, right. It's the occupiers, and you're just being oppressed.
Right, we've already got Occupy in West Virginia. The only problem is the people doing the Occupy and are the people who are also doing the oppressing. It's the coal industry.
Right. I'm sure the GDP per capita, too, for the individual in West Virginia is at probably a low.
Oh, Jesus, it's pathetic.
The Palestinians at $1,500 compared to $28,000. That's what oppression does.
Well, that's why I've said on this program a number of times that I've got more in common with a Palestinian than I do a lot of Americans.
Right. The money from West Virginia gets sucked into New York. That goes to Wall Street.
It goes to Frankfurt, it goes to London, it goes to Edinburgh, it goes to Zurich, it goes to Paris.
Right, it goes to the bankers, the big investors, the plutocrats, who stick the money in there on the and get the, you know, the expenses and the costs are all on the cheap. They're all borne by West Virginia. You guys pay for it. What's the word for that? Externalities. All the externalities are borne by West Virginia,
yeah.
Not by the the bankers at Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt, right?
Right, because, you know, those externalities amount to 3,975 dead innocent West Virginians every year, Andy.
Right, right. All the environmental damage is borne by you folks. And you don't get paid enough to clean that up in this state.
In some cases, not at all.
Right.
Yeah.
It sucks. Anyway, I've had my say.
Well, it's awful good to hear from you, Andy. You take care.
All right, big time. Still trying to... I got up in front of a DFA meeting. I gave a little pitch for H.R. 5959 yesterday, trying to get some of the folks to get on the horn and meeting the phone and call our Congress people, get them going.
Yeah, and you know, one other thing, just to point it out, if anybody wants to contact Tim Carpenter at Progressive Democrats of America, I think that could be very, very useful. We need we need H.R. 5959 to be a signature high-visibility issue for PDA.
Well, you know, they have it on their website. There is a spiel. There was a press release, and they put it on the PDA website because I remember seeing it there. So that was pretty impressive.
Oh, if we can bring the progressive community on board, I think we can make a lot more noise. See, we still need people like Ed Markey. We still need people like Waxman. We still need people like Frank Pallone.
I don't understand why the entire progressive caucus, which would be the the Raul Grijalva crew, there's like. 90 of them or something like that? It's the largest caucus in Congress. I think there's 90 of them. I don't know why the whole progressive caucus, but Frankie Pallone, my old congressman, he ain't no progressive. I mean, he might go out on a limb on a few issues.
Well, but see, the thing is, he was an
original... He's a DLC-er, man. Yeah, I know. He did some stuff and you alluded to Frankie in the past.
Yeah, he sponsored that piece of legislation that's a... I mean, it's good as far as it goes, but it doesn't stop mountaintop removal. He sponsored that.
Right.
There's no reason he shouldn't be on this.
No, this doesn't harm him. He has nothing to do. It's not going to hurt him in his New Jersey district whatsoever, so you think this should be a no-brainer for him. But Frankie's a DLC-er, man. He's a third way. So I don't know what... Like I said, this should be something he could sign on to. But other things, you know, he's not a progressive. He's not even effing close. He's a corporate Democrat. He's a Wall Street boy, big time.
And that, you know...
A little mafia. He's got a whole... He comes from a long line of plutocrats in New Jersey. You know, that's just another one that's, filling in his old man's footsteps.
Oh, we... You know...
Heavy hitter of New Jersey.
But you know what?
Democratic party in New Jersey.
We still need him. We still need him.
No, you need everybody you can get. Like I said, this shouldn't affect him. This is something he can look good at. To the environmentalist, New Jersey, and it shouldn't affect him at all. You know, like some of the Wall Street people get on his ass.
And so, you know, if there's anybody out there listening who is in Representative Pallone's district, get after him.
Yeah, that's the Jersey Shore.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Monmouth and Ocean County, which, like I said, shouldn't harm him at all in his home district. It should only be a plus for him, like I said, unless Wall Street gets on his. On his case, but mainly he's the healthcare guy because he was the head of the used to be when the Democrats were in charge. He was the head of the healthcare committee, so he had a lot to do with Obama's Affordable Care Act. And through him, and I used to call his office all the time. He would have nothing to do with single payer or the public option. That wasn't even in the cards with him. He's a pure capitalist insurance company guy. Period. End of story. Because that's who funds him. That's his major funder, the health insurance companies. Anyway.
Well, have yourself a great evening, Andy. Thanks for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
All right, man. Keep up the fire.
Gonna try. I got it. Yeah.
All right.
All right. Later now.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Andy calling from California. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Brother Bob. How are you today?
Brother Albert, how are you?
My goodness. Well, that was a good call by Andy. I got to agree with him on a lot of stuff.
Yeah, Andy, the Postal Service, notwithstanding, Andy never mails it in.
No doubt. Man, that was, yeah, Postal Postal Service. I'm telling you, we lose that, and you know. That's because ISA has lots of UPS and FedEx stock. Ain't no doubt in that game. And they're going to double it immediately. Immediately.
Oh, yeah.
Almost, you know, yeah. People cried about, oh, it went up another 2 cents again.
Yeah, wait till it costs you $15 to mail a postcard.
Yeah, seriously. And, you know, that sense of privilege is pretty disgusting, huh? Romney and the miners affected with the same debilitating condition. The same exact thing. They can't see the forest for the trees because they're both, you know, privileged and, you know, right? Don't the coal miners there have a sense of...
They have a sense of entitlement. They feel like they've got a constitutional right to blow up mountains.
Yeah, that's their coal. You know, I happened to watch, I don't know if anyone else caught it, but if you haven't, my God, if you want a nightmare, just a, you know, it's the compounding nightmare of reality. What's going on up in Alaska regarding this giant copper pit mine they want to throw at the headwaters of the last pristine salmon run in the world. And, you know, of course, it's, you know, I mean, the natives there that are against it, they already know. They already know. You know, I mean, there's one thing you can sometimes look at your struggle and, you know, feel good about is that at least somebody else is paying attention. You know, because all these natives there that know that, you know, the distilled water that these, you know, little spry fish need, you know, in order to, you know, develop until they can be out in the ocean and become that salmon that everyone likes, right? Salmon, it's a resource. We can catch 50% of it and it still be sustainable forever. But this coal, I mean, that coal, the copper and the gold and the bauxite and all the other things in there, they want to make a giant pit mine. Pit mine all the way down, fill all the tailings dams, 100 billion tons mountain range worth of tailings. And then locals know that in 50 years they'll say, oh, we declare bankruptcy. And then, you know, those tailings dams that need to be watched forever and maintained forever, you know, will just go to the state and the people. And, you know, of course we can afford that, right? We can afford to, you know, always clean up after these corporations, after they... And what are they doing with it? What are they doing with this money? What are they doing with it? I know that, what, $21 trillion is overseas, right? In the Mitt Romney, Captain Cobol, or Kolob Spaceship Club, right? They got $21 trillion sitting out, you know, wherever. Cayman Islands, corporations, so on. He's one of those guys that started one of those boogie nonsense corporations, didn't he? And this, oh my God, I can't believe this guy is weenier than John Kerry and twice as rich. He speaks French.
Toaster.
I mean, come on now. I mean, you know, and this is what they're voting for.
Now, you know, you know what? We just need to get Willard, but the Republicans are too smart for this, Albert. We need to get Willard into that sperm suit. Remember the sperm suit?
Yeah, when he went and visited the semiconductor lab or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I think Kerry and Dukakis both got talked into the sperm suit.
Yeah. Now they ain't gonna. I don't know though. Willard, you know, he can't walk. You know, he can barely walk. He can't go anywhere without insulting everyone. You know, I mean, he's got to pay dudes to kiss his ring. You know, what country was that? Was it Spain where he was at? And they're chanting Obama?
No, that was Poland, wasn't it?
Poland, yeah. Maybe, you know, even the people there. I know you guys are talking about, you know, and, yeah, we can see that, yeah, they were one of the coalition of the willing. Coalition of the willing. Oh, my God. Oh. Yeah, Poland, huh? You know, the people aren't there, and that's the thing. You know, I mean, you know, Mitt Romney. I mean, you know, if we want to see, you know, the total death of the, you know, he could bring it back. He has that special touch that he could bring us back to, you know, 1908.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It's time for Leave It to Willard. Starring Hugh Beaumont.
Yeah, that's right.
Jesus.
It's, oh, and
Act now, vote for Willard, and you get a free brand new closet to get back into.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, that's the other thing. I mean, the mask is off, Brother Bob. It's that mask has been off. Isn't it just the most grotesque creature? Just, and you know, oh my God. Oh my God.
No, I mean, yeah, we're moving, Willard's moving quickly toward Cthulhu land, right?
Yeah. Too quickly. I thought that's where, that thought that was him coming out. That's what I looked, it was scary then. It's scary.
Is his middle name Harkonnen?
Yeah, he is a Harkonnen. All those Replicants are Harkonnens. You know, I mean, if you read the book, you'll see, you know, what happens, you know, because they actually do talk about that planet. It's mined out. It's core, dead, lifeless, acrid. It's a desert wasteland with no worms.
Geedy, you know, Prime.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's Willard's, maybe that's the planet Willard gets. Maybe Willard gets Geedy Prime.
I mean, well, you gotta think how entitled you'd feel if you know you already have one. You know, who knows what it is.
Just passing through, folks, just picking up a little money. Yeah, Earth is just a big Stuckies for him.
Yeah. I like money, though. I like money. Yeah. It is a big Stuckies, one of them 7-Elevens. He's such a creep. This guy.
You know, and the oil reserves under the in the crust of planet Earth is just a big Slurpee.
Yeah.
It's a big gulp. It's a big gulp. It's a super big gulp.
Oh, my God. Mittens. My God. I like that. What is it? Rotten money.
Oh, raw money?
Raw money.
Raw money.
Raw money. Yeah, he likes money. I mean, you know, and what is Harry Reid doing? What is he doing?
I'd love to be able to, you know, I'd love to be that really super smart political analysis guy who can tell you. But you got the wrong show, Brother Albert.
No, that guy needs to sit down. You know, he's, I don't know, and you're right, I don't know why he is sending him. I don't understand. I don't get it. You know,
Well, I'll remember.
Where's his backbone? Come on.
Well, remember, Harry's, you know, Harry's got a spaceship, too.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he? Oh, my goodness. Oh, yeah, I offended somebody. I did the whole Scientologist. Oh, don't insult Mormons. Oh, so a Scientologist, that's okay. I mean, that's not okay, but the Mormons is okay. Okay. Okay.
Right, because it's got, you know, it's 18th century Scientology, so it's got that patina of been around for a while. You know, that's one of the curses of so short a human life, Albert. If we lived longer, I don't think we would do so many dumb things. Or maybe it would take longer to do dumb things. You know, if we were all, you know, there can be only one, you know, if we were all Highlander, then maybe we wouldn't, I don't know. Am I wrong? Would we still be just as stupid, just taking a longer view toward the stupid?
I would like to think that, you know, if people were around to see the impacts, you know, to see, when the Hoover Dam fails because there's not enough funding to remove all the silt and it comes, you know, it just cracks and then it's just a cracked wall in the mountain, you know what I mean? It's holding back this, you know, and there's a waterfall or whatever. You know, and then it becomes the Hoover waterfall. You know, I'd like to think that they would, I don't know, make things better. I mean, you look at it like this. You buy a washing machine, right? It lasts 5 years. Well, if you live for 1,000 years, how many freaking washing machines are you going to have in your life? The washing machine will become the bane of your existence, and you'll say to yourself, you know, in the 1,000 years that you live, you'll say, why can't they build one to last 7 years? You know, and hopefully that would start a whole new era of, like, let's see how long we can get things to last. And do we really need to, you know, constantly rip, you know, copper out of the ground? Well, we already have so much copper anyway. Why can't we just recycle it? You know, we're running out of these things. You would think that, you know, the health effects when people would actually have to live with some, you know, misanformed, you know, limb and what have you, and or have, you know, their sixth kidney transplant or kidney printing, you know, going to the organ bank is a monthly occurrence. You would get tired of doing that, you would think. You know, but I don't know. They keep showing the same dumb crap on TV, so you never know. People have a long, you know, it might be 1,000 years of just reruns. And
well, you know, that's why I find so much value in speculative fiction, Brother Albert. You know, whether we're talking about Dune or, for instance, the book that Reverbo put us all onto a long time back, Richard K. Morgan's Altered Carbon. It's exactly that, the book Repo Men.
Mm-hmm.
Repo Men deals with, you know, going to the Oregon Bank for a new one every 6 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and the whole credit bubble that develops on over what happens when you can't make the payments on your new heart. There's an element of necessarily fiction. It's a, you know, some people can see things that other people can't see.
And you know, by using, you know, these symbolisms like that, you know, hopefully we get it and start to change the direction. That's the whole point, right? What did he say? I don't write science fiction to make it true. I mean, I don't write science fiction, you know, to scare you. I write science fiction so it doesn't happen. That kind of stuff. Was that Robert Heinlein said that? Somebody said.
Yeah.
And I know I'm butchering the hell out of it, but, you would think that we would say, hey, you know, learn from other people's mistakes, you know.
Right.
I mean, I like to think that the natives in Alaska, you know, they value the salmon too much. It's too deep in their, you know, heritage to go along with this. Because it really is, you know, I mean, it's a complete reverse mountain, you know, these pit mines. You know, I mean, these things are ridiculous. You know, I think they could fit 3 of the anacondas into this one that they're planning.
Yeah, the anaconda copper, right, yeah.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden they start talking about, you know, you could see the lobbyists, right? No, we're not going to kill any fish. We're just going to hurt copper. You know, and he's like, oh, mining district. You go, he's like Jabba the Hutt. You can see it. You can see that. I mean, it's like you look at this guy. You're 70 years old. You know, by the time this thing even, you know, breaks ground, you'll, you know, more than likely be on the next adventure there. I think somebody like that should have to stick around. You know, sometimes, you know, we should have eternity elixirs or whatever, and, you know, to really heinous criminals, give it to them and then seal them in plexite or something. And, you know, like they can never get out. They're in this ball and they don't get to breathe or drink or whatever, but they get to watch maybe the world become a really awesome place and be a lesson for everybody. That's who deserves the eternities. These, you know, people that destroy others' lives for no reason.
Oh, by the way, Albert, I got to tell you got email in from Tim from L.A.
Oh, hey, Tim.
He said about Alaska and salmon. He said, sadly, speaking of Alaska and the salmon, even if Alaska does everything, even if the U.S. does everything to clean the U.S. and all pollution and reintroduce the salmon to a cleaner environment, he said, would you please remind Brother Albert that we still have Fukushima to contend with, and a lawsuit won't work because of the goddamn Alien Law Act, a.k.a. tort reform for foreign countries. And what he says is true. And I might also add that I saw something fly across the screen earlier today that bluefin tuna from Fukushima are now being found off the West Coast, you know, because they do migrate.
Mm.
And they're bringing their little radioactive selves.
Mm-hmm.
There went Saturday night's trip to the sushi joint.
Hey, you know what? May you know what? And I'm going to see the silver lining on this. I have to. Perhaps that's good. Maybe fish need to be radioactive for a couple of decades so we stop eating them like they're infinity. You know, there's an infinite supply. You know, maybe they can handle it and withstand and, you know, adapt and, you know.
It's about the only silver lining there is.
I mean, and this is the only thing I could think of in terms of that, because we definitely need, you know, the ocean to be in a better condition. You know, and now the radioactivity, I know it's there.
Wait a minute, Albert. There you go thinking with that rational, higher level primate brain you've got. You know, if the fish are radioactive, let's not eat the fish for a while. Because, man, that's all Occam's razor and simple and elegant, right?
Well.
Okay, can I give you the right wing lizard brain consume it all as fast as you can alternative?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know. Sit down.
New
from GlaxoSmithKline. Radioactive tuna getting you down? Eat all you want. We've got super anodized iodine formulation that we've recently patented, and it'll take care of that cobalt, thorium, G, and iodine. And
nobody's buying that. No way. They could try.
You don't think? Wait a minute. I just happen to have my ruin Scott and Linda's dinner story right here. From Mother Jones, charts. Why your chicken is still making you sick. And you know, we've kind of gotten lost in the weeds, as Dr. John noted, with the whole Chick-fil-A thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like if you go over to the Colonel's, you're going to get a better Chick-fil-A, or better chicken, okay?
They love homosexuals at the Colonel's, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I got to run that, don't I? But no, all this stuff, there is no better chicken. Well, I mean, there is some, but it's damned hard to find. Maybe your little co-op there in Wisconsin has it, Albert. You know, organic, no hormones, no yada, right. You know, grew a beak during its life, that kind of thing.
Yep. Ate crickets.
Yeah, over at the Tom Hill pot over at Mother Jones notes, got a tummy ache? It could well be something you ate. That's the message from the Centers for Disease Control. This is just mind-boggling. That's the message from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's latest assessment of foodborne illnesses dropped on its website with zero fanfare. In other words, don't say anything that might make the industry upset. Not even a press release Friday afternoon last. It shows that infection rates for most common food-related pathogens are either inching up or holding steady and occurring, and this is important, at levels above the CDC's own targets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're talking about Campylobacter, Salmonella, Shigella,
mm-hmm.
Listeria.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, and of course we've only have three antibiotics that we use. And of course, you know, these antibiotics are, you know, sitting there. And you know what? And you know what? Maybe I am a little Pollyannish, you know, because...
I'm not saying that.
Was coming at, no, hang on, because just where Andy was calling from, you know, it's a little drought, you know, going on, and, you know, people's grass is kind of getting brown, and they can't sell their house, so they've been painting their grass green, and that makes me write to the sun and ask the sun for a triple gamma ray burst, you know, just get it on standby in case, you know, they do sell GlaxoSmithKline anti-iodine monohydrated, you know, whatever, eat pills. If that happens, I'm telling you, I'll light the sun, we'll have a triple gamma ray burst, and we'll start over from sponges and anemone. That's what we'll start from again. I mean, it just has to happen, because sponges will be all right. They're tough. You know, these human beings, you know, I mean, we can't have this kind of crap. And, you know, that's the other thing, too. You're painting your freaking lawn green. That's true. Go look.
Yes.
That's a true story. Painting your lawn green when it's a worthless piece of land anyway. I mean, lawn is worthless. It's garbage. You know, if foodborne illness is getting you down, grow your own freaking chickens. You know, well, you're not employed. What else are you doing? You know, plant some eggplant. Plant some of this. Plant one zucchini and feed.
Yeah, I love it. I love it that we have toxins to throw on our yards to keep the actual grasses that are good for us from living. I'm thinking in this instance in particular of course, dandelions.
Dandelion, yeah. Which, of course, in turn feed the bees, which, of course, in turn, you know, give us fruits and nuts and most things.
And you know what? A dandelion doesn't mind it a damned little bit, Albert. If you go out and you pick the little tender green leaves, they're going to shoot that flower up anyway. They're going to put that puffball up. There's going to be more dandelions. And oddly enough, you know, let's see, Dan and Yogurt promoted, what was it, Ukrainians some years back as being so ever so long-lived. Well, some other long-lived people are on the island of Crete. I can remember we used to have a listener from Crete. I don't know if he's still out there. I hope he is. He was trying to get into graduate school here in the U.S. If you're there, hey. But the diet in Crete seems to produce people who live to be 100 and some, too.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what they eat just an absolute boatload of?
I know exactly what they eat.
Dandelion greens.
That's right.
They have them for lunch. They have them for dinner. They have them on toast at breakfast. They cook them. They braise them. They stew them. They boil them. They have them in salads.
Yeah,
and they're good.
Yeah. My grandmother brought them. I mean, I know her family brought dandelions, you know, from Italy. You know, I mean, it's part of the things you're supposed to grow. I mean, it's part of the crops and the food sources that we used to grow, you know, for hundreds of years. You know, and it's right in your yard, and you're sitting here spraying God knows what on it. I mean, it's, you know, and of course, you know, you're not going to kill it either. You know, nature is a little stronger than that, you know. Now they have, right, how many Roundup resistant plants that we,
right.
How many? You know what I mean? And that's, you know, we think we affect, you know, we think we're gonna beat them, but what we're doing is we're poisoning ourselves. We're drinking the poison and thinking we're gonna hurt somebody else. You know, it's stupid and dumb, and I hope we're starting to, you know, I think people are starting to get it. There's far more people when I say, hey, you know, rip up some of your stupid yard that gets sun. Make something useful out of it. You know, you see this stuff happening all over the place. It's happening on the television, which is good. It's, you know, people, you know, that couple just retired to become self-sustaining, you know. And I mean, I remember when I was growing up, there was another old couple, and they went up to Maine and did the same thing. And I remember it shocked me. I remember they didn't have TV. And I was like, wow, you don't have TV? You know, but yeah, and they went up there, and they're not alone. You know, there's a lot of people that are going and homesteading and doing these kinds of things, but a lot of us are stuck in suburbia or stuck in a small town, you know. So, well, why do you need a lawn? What the hell is your lawn doing for you?
You know what? I was looking for reasons that don't bear the detail, but I was looking up the Zac Brown Band earlier today.
Okay.
And it turns out the Zac Brown Band, as of like March 2011, put up a song for sale for 99 cents over at Patagonia.com. You know, they make clothing, Patagonia does. And in turn, they take their profits and they turn them back into organizations that are trying to make this a more livable planet. And the Zac Brown Band gave the proceeds of their 99-cent song to an organization called, it was something like Urban Farmers, for taking brownfields and turning them back into productive spaces where people can grow food to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a possibility.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that plus, I mean... I just lost it. Damn it, Brother Bob. But yeah, no, you know, turning that stuff, city gardening, rural gardening, you know, just gardening, it's good for you, it's good for your kids, it's good for everybody, and then you get to eat it, you know, and I mean, you know.
Watch out for those polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons in the soil, or at least that's what we have to do here.
Hey, and you know what, honestly, what's the worst? The worst you can do is what? Compost everything. Right? Let the micronutrients in your soil, billions of them we can't even identify. You know, put some solar panels. Solar panels getting so cheap now. What? 26% of Germany's electricity this summer is being generated by solar alone. 26%. I mean, why does this higher latitude, I mean, they're higher latitude than we are here down in Wisconsin, and we're higher than you. You know what I mean? So if we could do it, you could do it, and anyone else in this freaking country could do it, and why can't this country have 80% of its sun, of its electricity from solar? I know the bad, hey, liquid earth batteries, go Google the video and
hey,
watch it.
And right. You know, we do like the occasional hopeful moment, and I got one for you. And it's only fair because I've been gooning on Iowa's 5th congressional district for at least two nights now. You know, those are the goobers who send Steve King to the Congress. And Steve King apparently is still working on figuring out that whole law of holes thing because after the whole dogfighting thing and then yesterday the story about how his explanation about the dogfighting thing where he explained that it's legal in America to kidnap little girls, take them across state lines, rape them, and then get them an abortion.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know. Okay. I know. Well, today, he doubled down.
Yay!
And he said that, damn. This may be one of those, but yay! The eye.
I'm telling you, you feel it.
Now, he said today that diversity has never been America's strong suit. So that's why the Congress should pass a law that he proposed that would make English the official U.S. language, and it would unify the country. And here's the quote.
What year is this guy from?
Here's the quote. It's apparently some year that doesn't recognize the fact that Spanish was the first European language spoken on the in any continent of the Americas. But screw us and our history, right, Albert?
Yeah. Oh, what's that? Yeah.
One of the great things about America is we've been unified by a common language. That common language, of course, is English. Our language is getting subdivided by some forces of the federal government. It's time to speak with a common voice. The argument that diversity is our strength has really never been backed up by logic. Its unity is where our strength is. Our founding fathers understood that. Modern-day multiculturalists are defying that. And just as Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions would, he was all offended yesterday. Well, Steve King, he's offended too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He said it's offensive that anybody would say his bill's racist.
Mm-hmm.
He said they should be specific about that rather than just hurl that out there. That divides people. But he's already said we're already divided. But no, that's just to let you know that Steve King's still being Steve King. On the other hand, and you will, and I will, and the Horn family will, Albert, be proud of this. I don't anticipate asking anybody to vote for Iowa Governor Terry Branstad anytime soon. But Willard done come out and said, once he gets to be president of the spaceship, I mean America.
Captain of president.
Yeah. Beautiful. Once he gets to be captain, president, fleet admiral, damn it, captain my ass, that he's going to make sure that wind production tax credit goes away. He was campaigning in Colorado, and he said, I like it. Wait, no, really, not kidding. I like renewables. That's what he said. That was his support for renewable energy. I like renewables. I like money. But he said, you know, that damn socialist, communist wind power tax credit's out of here. Okay? Well, over there, not too awful far from Colorado, there's Iowa way, where the governor is Republican Terry Branstad. And Iowa has 7,000 people putting food on their families because they've got jobs in the wind energy sector.
Mm-hmm.
And Iowa Governor Terry Branstad said it needs to be continued. Not forever, but it does need to be continued for a while. And the result is it's been a very good thing for Iowa in terms of 20% of our energy is now generated by wind. We have a lot of farmers that receive rent from having wind turbines on their property, and we have a lot of jobs associated with it.
That's right.
He said of Willard and the wind tax credit, they don't understand. You got a bunch of people that have put that website together that are a bunch of East Coast people that need to get out here in the real world to find out what's going on. Governor Branstad, stay off small aircraft and don't get on the spaceship. That book, To Serve Man, it's a cookbook.
But come on, Brother Bob. You know, progress, that's why it's nice and so important that we get every little seed of progress, every little tiny little millimeter that we can get, because it has a way of liberalizing things. It has a way of making, you know, I mean, when, especially when it makes sense. You know, and, you know, right now, all right, it may be, you know, some sort of thing that, you know, is subjective, and that's fine. But once, you know, everyone has solar panels on their roof, and once, you know, you have a five, you know, you pay your 5-year lease or what have you on your panels, and yeah, right, we'll have subsidies for a while, and it'll be good for everybody for a little bit, and then it'll gradually get phased out as we become more and more self-sufficient, and that's how it's going to be, and the more you'll have another extra $250, and that's where my power bill is going up to this summer. You know, it's going up, you know, because it goes up in the summer. It's, you know, more demand, you know. So next thing you know, they double the kilowatt hours. This kind of crap is going to continue until you got $800 bills every month. And that's the future. It's either $800 bills every month or, you know, $6 bills. You know, that's a no-brainer. Why wouldn't you? You know, yeah, it's just how it is. Yeah, and now, you know, granted, you know, Mittens will certainly, you know, Reaganize everything, and he'll just finish turning the clock back, you know.
Maybe we could get Willard to pay a visit to the Neshoba County, Mississippi Fairgrounds and talk a little bit about states' rights. No, don't say that, Bob. No.
He's a really...
Because he'll do it. And the problem is, all them people in Neshoba County, Mississippi, and all over Mississippi stand will say, see, even if he is a Starfleet admiral, he's still one of us because he believes in states' rights.
Yeah, he's a sovereign nation between sovereign powers, sovereign. Yeah, he is a Bush. He's dumber than Bush.
Yeah, he really is.
Dumber than Bush.
And you know, but maybe we're the dumb ones. Maybe getting rid of the wind tax credit, as Irish Dave just said, maybe getting rid of the wind tax credit's one of them Anglo-Saxon things that we wouldn't understand.
Oh, okay. I mean, until we're self-sufficient in power generation in this world and country, there should be some, you know, I mean, this is investment. It's investment, goddammit. I'm so sick of these people and talking big government and da-da-da-da while they sit here and rob us and steal from us at every turn. I mean, look at these guys. Look at Mitt Romney. Get out of here with Mitt Romney bringing, you know, he's the forefront of the outsourcing. Forefront of it. That's this guy. You know, he's one of them. He's a pod person, this guy. You know, I've never seen anyone cutting their, you know, faces off like they do trying to support him. It just, you know, and does he have any, I mean, for real? What was he yelling? What did his, have some goddamn, shut the fuck up, kiss my ass, this is a holy site. What was that? What the hell was that? Why doesn't he answer any questions? I mean, they know exactly why he's not answering any questions, why he stays away from the press. You know why? You know why? And he ain't going to win, so let's just, you know, let's not get too depressed. We just got to motivate our people that, you know, we do have something in the future here. You know, we have an eye on the future. And, you know, in the future there will be windmills everywhere. And, yes, it'll be in your backyard. And, no, it's not going to kill billions of birds. And da-da-da-da-da, and it's going to be pretty, and you're going to look at it, and they're going to take the ones when they're used up and old and the technology gets better. They're going to take them down and turn them into a playground or recycle them into more. You know, I mean, that's sense. That makes sense, and that's what the sense is where we need to go. And that's why, you know, just everyone, you know, listening to my voice or whatever else and what have you, you know, just talk sense to people every time you get the chance. And that's all you can do. You know, not in my backyard, my ass. You ever seen a windmill? My God, how gorgeous is that thing? You know, put it in my backyard, please. Oh, what about the sun? I'll tint my windows.
Consider what Governor Branstad said, Albert. There's a lot of farmers in Iowa that are getting rent payments off of windmills. Here's your choice. Mm-hmm. You can have yourself a wind turbine and have to go out with one of them little sweeper thingies and a little whisk broom and pick up little piles of Indiana bat ceviche every couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at best or worst. On the other hand, you could rent out your mineral rights to the fracking company.
Yep.
And you could quit having water for your cattle.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could rent out your land to the Trans-Keystone XL Pipeline, Glory to God, America's Great Company International.
Mm-hmm.
And run the risk of having your entire farm covered up in crude, black gold, Texas tea, and they ain't gonna let you move to Beverly.
And Brother Bob, real quick.
I mean, I'm with the windmill.
And real quick, you know, we had that tar sand pipeline burst in Michigan.
Yes.
Why are they always near water? I think there should be, if you're going to make a pipeline, it has to be buried and encapsulated. You know what I mean? Like, really buried and encapsulated, and that way, you know, it'll be there. It'll be like a Roman. You have to be built to Roman standards. You know what I mean? It has to be at least built to that, and it can't be right next to a creek, for Christ's sakes. You know, this is the thing. I don't understand where people don't understand how water is so vital to us. I just don't, you know.
But the same crowd that doesn't recognize that doesn't recognize that they're never going to be as rich as Willard. I mean, you and I joke about the spaceship and the fleet admiral and everything, but there's only one downside to that. You have to die to get on the spaceship. And that, for me, at least, is a little off-putting.
Mm-hmm.
That whole gotta-die part of it. Yeah, that's the key to the intergalactic benefits program, dropping dead.
But you can't even get in. There's only 144,000 or something like that.
I thought that was the Jehovah's Witnesses.
I think they're all like, you know, I think they're all in cahoots. I don't even know who these people are.
They're all doing their ciphering.
Yeah, there's some crazy stuff going down, you know. It's just weird. They're all like, you know, different flavors of Coke. But, it's spaceship my rear end. You know, Earth is our spaceship.
There is no planet B. I just love that saying.
This is our spaceship. We're not going anywhere for any length, you know, maybe in 10,000 years. Maybe we will figure out ways to really propel ourselves, you know, through vortexes or what have you. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? And you never know. But we're not going to get there following Mitt Romney and the rest of the Harkonnen. Then we're not going to get there. We'll be eating each other. You know, this is Easter Island, you know.
Yeah, Rapa Nui. Watch the movie.
It's either that or the Enterprise. You know, this is the Enterprise. And this is, you know, only place we've got. You know, maybe we can get it to other places, but not if we can't take care of this one, because all those other planets, they're in worse shape than this one, you know. But, you know, so we're going to have to, maybe it's important. Maybe it's
you don't want to go to Giddy Prime.
True, but maybe, you know, the Sensei Master is directing us to make a big mess and then have to clean it all up, and maybe we'll have to learn our lesson. I don't know. But I do know that there's, you know, promising technology, there's promising developments. There are farmers in Iowa starting to say, nah, we want...
Your book was in the place, but you knew where every speck of dust was in the place. And I went to her once and said I wanted to do in the English department. Come on in. I was doing a seminar in the English department on radical literature of the 1930s. And I wanted to do, I'm a historian, so I wanted to do something historical. And I went to Ruth and I said, any ideas? And she said, there are some radical newspapers in the 1930s that published reader's fiction. And you could do a research paper on the fiction. It was just wonderful. And she took me right to them, let me take them out of the library. Those days are great. I mean, you know, the Internet has a lot to recommend it, but the Internet can't supply Miss Ruth Davis, I don't think. Okay. I have to introduce myself. I'm Bob Bliss. I'm Dean of the Honors College at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. I am a historian and did hold an academic appointment at Lancaster University in England for 27 years. And before that, I ran into him at University of Wisconsin. My specialty is colonial history, with an emphasis on, right now, on colonial religious history, early American religious history. And my current project is to finish a book started by my major professor on 17th century religion. The family, he died in 1999. The family has asked me to complete the book. And it has, the working title is, Was God Aboard the Mayflower? And if anybody wants an answer to that one, I'll be glad to supply it. But today, tonight, I want to talk about human rights, topic Bill introduced very well this afternoon, and human rights in the colonial period. They get to the revolution, but human rights in the colonial period, which is conventionally defined to extend from the first settlement in Virginia, 1607, to the backdrop to the American Revolution in the 1760s. I'm going to start with what I hope is a good teacher's question. You're all teachers. Why should West Virginia school students be interested in what happened before July the 4th, 1776? Do you all teach high school or middle school? Pardon?
Elementary.
So, you know, this is a very interesting question, and perhaps we can explore why your pupils should be interested as we go along. reminds me of a story I told to this group's predecessor a couple of years ago, and those of you who are here a couple of years ago have my permission to fall asleep while I tell it. My father and I were at Independence Hall in Philadelphia in 1963, and going through and seeing the sights and so on and so forth. And as you walked out then, way back then, there was a visitor's book where you could sign and make comments. And the person before us was a woman from a small town in Georgia. Can't remember its name exactly, but it was a name like Possum Trot or something like that. And her comment was, how wonderful it is to be back here before the beginning of time. So that's where we're going to start tonight. before the beginning of time. And the term human rights is a good place to start. Human rights is one of the three central themes of this summer academy. And it is also going to be a central theme of the Center for the Study of the Constitution that Bill O'Brien has established here in Beckley. And we'll be searching for funds for if anybody would like to contribute. The term human rights seems to assume that each one of us, all of us, enjoy certain rights or immunities or freedoms because we are human. The term human rights got us into a little bit of trouble in the mid-40s when we sat down with the other members of the United Nations organization, that fledgling organization that became United Nations. And It was thought after the outrages of the Second World War, especially in Nazi Germany, it was thought to be a good idea for the United Nations to begin with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And it turned out that that term was a little bit trouble. It meant different things to different cultures. Human rights was a loaded term. So let's put it a bit less broadly. Say citizens' rights. The rights we enjoy because we are citizens. Now, right from the first, we have to concede that citizens' rights are not absolute. We enjoy those rights because we belong to a society. The society retains certain rights. It may be a right to drive a car, but not if you're 12 years old on a public street. Middle school students can't vote in real presidential elections. And if you still have junior proms, my school did way back when, you can't serve beer at a junior prom. But we get some citizens' rights quite early at birth. And if we live in society, other citizens' rights accrue as we go through life. We're all accustomed to that. It seems like a normal course of events. The older we get, up to a certain point, which I'm just about at, our rights increase or become more secure. And then people start to want to take them away because you're behaving strangely. Or you forget who your wife is or things like that. We're accustomed to it, but it's really a pretty new phenomenon. It's not the human experience forever. And that's important because one thing that you really do need to teach your students and get them to understand or try to understand, it's not an easy lesson to learn, is that the past was a different country. It's one of those places we study that is different from the place we inhabit now. It may have contributed to our current place. We think so. That's one of the basic assumptions of history. But it was a different place. And you don't have to get to be very old to understand that. I need to tell you a story about how rights change just from the perspective of my mother, who died in 2010 at the age of 94, well, a few days short of her 94th birthday. She came from a family that was always concerned with African-American civil rights, or she would have said the civil rights of colored people. Her grandfather fought in the Civil War, on the correct side, of course, and became a congressman in Washington, where he was a fierce defender of Negro rights. Her mother-in-law, at the age of 21, graduated from college in 1901 at Ames, Iowa, Iowa State College, and went and taught in a black school in South Carolina for 4 years. So it was that when Elson Floyd, an African-American, became president of the University of Missouri System, where I work, my mother was visiting, and he was holding his first official occasion at the University of Missouri St. Louis, a kind of press conference where everyone was supposed to show up and applaud and, you know, a public occasion. My mother wanted to go, and she wanted to sit in the front row, and so she was pretty infirm, so we went early and got in the front row, and Elson did his performance very well, very polished. Then my mother said, "I want to meet him." So I said, "Okay, Mom." There was not a one to be defied. So we went up to the podium, and I had already met Floyd, and so I said, "President Floyd, my mother would like to meet you." And he said, ma'am. Perfect gentleman. And my mother said, and just embarrassed me terribly at first, she said, I just wanted to see the black man who was president of the University of Missouri system. To her, it was a great occasion, because Missouri, she knew, as an Iowan, she knew that Missouri had been segregated for most of her adult life, Missouri system. And Floyd responded beautifully. He said, well, ma'am, here I am. Okay, human rights, civil rights, citizens' rights do change through time. So much more through a lifetime of 94 years, so much more through the lifetime of the American colonies, 1600 to whatever date you like, 1776, 1787. Because in 1600, that normal progression that we are accustomed to in modern democratic societies, That normal accretion of human rights, of citizens' rights, was very truncated. And I sat down last night to list the rights that people didn't have in 1600 in England. Voting was not a right. Historians argue, of course, over how many people in England, early modern England, could vote. And across the whole spectrum of the society, probably 10% of adult males could vote. Of course, women couldn't vote. And, of course, children couldn't vote. But the right varied. It wasn't a certain property level, or it wasn't a certain station of birth, or because England was, the English Parliament had 450 different constituencies, and except for the county constituencies, those 45 English shires that had the same 40 shilling freehold constituency, if your state was worth 40 shillings a year, you could vote. Most of the constituencies were town corporations and trading corporations, where who could vote depended on what was in the charter. Depended on the terms of the charter. You might have to buy your freemanship in the town of Lancaster. And it might, in Lancaster, it might be very expensive. So only a few people could vote. In the city of Birmingham, it was a wider constituency. So you couldn't tell. And certainly, the right to vote did not adhere to you because you were resident in the city or you had a certain amount of... It adhered... You had the right because of what the charter said. It was an exclusive privilege. Depended on who asked for the royal charter. Charters were renewed because local corporations wanted more people to be able to vote. Or charters were renewed because local corporations wanted fewer people to be able to vote. And they bribed the king. Well, that's not what they called it. They paid fees. And the crown usually obliged because it was a ceremonial way of renewing the relationship between the subject, not the citizen, the subject and the crown. There was a laying on of the hands. Pleasantries were exchanged, gifts were exchanged, the new charter was given, it was sealed, great ceremony with the Great Seal of England, a wax seal, and off went the corporation with a different constituency than it had brought to London, a different voting constituency. Anyway, it was not an absolute right, it was not a citizen's right. It was not a right in England in 1600 to own property absolutely. This is very important. One of the great unsung heroes of the development of American capitalism is that our property is alienable. We own it pretty much absolutely in fee simple. or as the term was in the 17th century, according to the manner of, according to the custom of the manor of East Greenwich. Anybody know where East Greenwich is? Been watching the Olympics, you should. Okay. East Greenwich is east of Greenwich, which is east of London. And in that manner, unusually, that medieval English manor, freeholders owned their property absolutely. And it was a very unusual right. Very unusual right. And the alienability of property, the fact that we own our property, subject to zoning laws and all the rest of it, but we own our property absolutely, has been a huge engine of economic growth. Peru doesn't have, people in Peru don't have this right, and it holds them back. In most other places in England outside of the manor of East Greenwich, even freeholders were technically and practically tenants of the crown. The crown gave all land titles, and if you had it freely, you could sell it subject to certain restrictions on the crown and paying license fees and so on and so forth. And you paid quit rents. And if you know your Virginia history, you know that quit rents were exported to Virginia as an English custom. It was not a right to have people did not have a general right to a jury trial in England in 1600. And in those cases where a jury was impaneled, your case might be heard in a prerogative court where no jury existed. And where a jury was impaneled to hear your case, if the Crown thought the jury had made a mistake, it could imprison the jury until they figured out what the right decision was. Anybody know what case ended that right of the Crown? It involved a famous American colonial entrepreneur, William Penn. He was charged with sedition in 1671. He was a Quaker radical. And he was a very skillful, intelligent man. He defended himself very well, and the jury said, not guilty. And the Attorney General of England imprisoned the jury until such time as they should see reason. And the case burbled on. And the Lord Chief Justice somewhat surprisingly found that juries should no longer be imprisoned if they came up with the wrong decision. The wrong decision was always not guilty. I shouldn't say always. I know of no wrong decision that was guilty. Okay? It was not a right to receive humane treatments by the courts or by the state, particularly if one were suspected of a serious crime, for instance, witchcraft or treason. Then one could indeed anticipate torture as an investigative technique, as the victims at Salem found in 1691, 1692. You could also, if charged, or if not charged, just if suspected, you could also languish in jail for a very long time until the Crown decided it might get around to actually charging you and having the case out in court. And to add insult to the injury of long incarceration, you might have to pay rent while you were in jail. Well, it was a privilege. You're the guest of the king. I mean, come on. Be reasonable. It was not your right to speak or publish freely. Publishing was licensed. Plays, even by the, were vetted by the Lord Chamberlain, an official of the crown. Books were licensed by authority.
Seventh right you would not have is the right to worship freely, even in Protestant England. Now, after the Protestant Reformation, England made quite a bit out of that. The Protestants had freedom of conscience because, after all, everyone in England was a member of the Protestant Church of England and they were free to be so. Right? Got it? They weren't free to be a member of another church, but they were free to be a member of the Protestant Church of England. And certainly it was not your right to worship freely. In Catholic countries like Spain or Sicily, where the Inquisition had taken root. Beyond that limitation, it was certainly not a right of a congregation, however orthodox their theological views, it was not the right of a congregation to call or ordain their own minister, or decide on who was or who was not a communicant member of their church. Indeed, for asserting these rights, in Queen Elizabeth's England, several persons were hanged, drawn, and quartered. Not a pleasant experience, I'm told. Something your students might be more interested in, and especially in country districts in West Virginia, it was not a right to fish or hunt on public access land or water. Indeed, this is a slightly dangerous statement. I think it's probably true, but don't quote me. There was no such thing as public access land or water in the realm of England. Even the ocean was the king's pond. Everything else was poaching and carrying a fishing pole on somebody else's property, let alone a firearm, was definitely not among the citizens' rights of English people. An eighth right, corporate rights. Corporate rights were not in a much stronger position. There were parliamentary constituencies, of course. But Parliament, think of the name, Parliament. What do you suppose that meant originally? Parliament. Parley? What? Talk. Speak. Parliament was a place where people came together to talk to each other, not to make decisions, and certainly not to require the Crown to agree with any decisions that Parliament made. Parliament was a court. And the sovereign power, according to constitutional theorists of the early 17th century, was not Parliament, but the king in Parliament. Parliament had no power apart from the Crown. The Crown called parliamentary elections. The Crown cancelled parliamentary elections. The Crown declared when an elected Parliament was or was not in session. The Crown declared Parliament not to be in existence, as did Charles I in the so-called 11 years rule immediately preceding the outbreak of the English Civil War. A right Americans treasure a great deal, along with the right to own our own property, our own cash, our own real property, and do with it what we will, is a right to trade, to buy and sell freely on an open market, to get the best price you can for your goods or your time or your skills. These were all severely limited rights in early modern England. For most people in early modern England, not all, but most in early modern England, these economic rights were defined, like the right to vote, in your specific membership in a specific corporation or guild. And if you were a householder in the borough, I lived in Lancaster, so I use Lancaster as an example. If you were a householder in the borough of Lancaster, and you had some fish to sell, you had to go to a licensed fishmonger and somehow give them to him, and he would sell them for you. You had no right. So your economic right to buy and sell and trade was defined by your membership in this or that group. Indeed, the source of all right. Oh, I want to add one thing from today's conversation. This is a little bit complicated. Skating on thin ice. In a way, the right to government was not a right. Government was thought to be, at best, the badge of man's lost innocence, to quote Thomas Paine, much later theorist. The idea that government was and should be a positive agent of change, that government would change things in any fundamental way, was pretty foreign to the way people thought politics. Government reified, ratified what was in existence. Government was a terror to evildoers. Government punished crime. The idea that government changed things. It was beginning to grow, but it was beginning to grow on people, but it was not an automatic assumption. And the source of all rights, ironically, the rights that did exist lay not with our humanity, nor with Englishmen's men's citizenship, or with their particular level of wealth, except in certain cases. Ironically, the main source of rights, liberties, privileges, freedoms in England was the crown, was the prerogative, the royal prerogative. Only the crown could grant a secure right. Only the crown could grant a secure title. An irony to us, because we think of rights as being somehow natural, universal, belonging to all citizens of a certain age, at least. But to legal and constitutional conservatives in early modern England, this all made perfect sense. The crown was the fountain of all power, all privilege, all right. It was the glue that held the whole social order together. The Constitution, in a sense, was the crown. The crown was the Constitution, the royal prerogative. So where else could you securely locate my right or your right than with the crown? That was the place. So, for instance, there's some really interesting technicalities here. The Corporation of Massachusetts Bay in New England, the Massachusetts Colony Charter Government, was granted by the crown. And some of you know from 2 years ago, the crown granted to the Corporation of Massachusetts Bay in New England Charles I, out of our mere grace and motion, what a great phrase, I'm doing it because I damn well please. Out of our mere grace and motion, we grant to the Governor and Company of Massachusetts Bay and those whom they shall later welcome into their friendship, rights, privileges, and powers. And they're listed. Here's what you can do. Boom, 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 boom. And there is not an implied clause. There's not a general welfare clause, as in the American Constitution. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. If you did something outside of that, you were in some danger of arrogating to yourself the sovereign power, which in early modern law was a dangerous thing to do. It was known as treason. Counterfeit. Coining money without outside the royal mint, without the king's legal, was a capital crime. There are all sorts of other capital crimes. But that was a very important capital crime because counterfeiting was an infringement, a clear infringement of the king's sovereignty. And the Massachusetts colony did just that. Pine tree shilling. Its currency shortages were so bad as a colonial economy that in 16... Anybody know the date? I should. 1650. John Hull agreed to become the mint master and committed treason on a daily basis. the colony of Massachusetts also incorporated towns. The town of Ipswich, the town of the village of Salem, not the village of Salem, the town of Salem, the town of Boston. The colony gave to the founding fathers of each town about a 36 square mile tract and said, you're a town, you're a corporate town. And they got in trouble. This is one of the reasons the charter was vacated in the English courts in 1686. Vacated, it was declared illegal and of no power. Because Massachusetts had sub-incorporated, and that was a right that only the crown had. Okay, that was the situation in 1600. People had rights, but the rights often almost always inherited in a previous royal grant and inherited in a particular status that you enjoyed as a stockholder in a corporation, as a householder, a licensed householder, registered householder, as a 40-shilling freehold owner in a county constituency. Particular rights. In the case of the colonies, your particular rights were that you were a freeman of the colony of Massachusetts or a freeman of the colony of Virginia or a lord proprietor of Carolina. Now, it's a mistake to think that all this changed in America and didn't change anywhere else. A lot was going on in England to expand the area of rights, to begin to move towards our modern conception that you and I have rights because we were born. It's okay. We belong. This is our territory. The old system of right, the licensed, exclusive, privileged whole hierarchy of chartered rights and so on, would work as long as everybody was a member of this or that caste or corporation or guild or whatever. But in early modern England, the economy was changing so fast, that whether they wished to or not, whether they had the right or not, English people had to start to buy and sell labor, goods, even property to each other willy-nilly. It was literally illegal. I mean, literally in the sense of being outside the law. Does anybody know what kind of law arose to take? Because, you know, when you do that, I agree with Brian that on August the 15th, I will sell you this lecture for tuppence if you pay for it. Okay? And then on August 15th, I said, sorry, Brian. Deal's off. What recourse does Brian have? You're all witnesses. Come on. Yeah, breach of contract. Common law. The common law arises organically, starting, it's always like, as usual. But certainly it's well underway in the 16th century. The common law arises to regulate economic relations between people who are otherwise free of one another. Real freedom. I owe Brian nothing. He owes me nothing. Except we agreed that I would sell him my lecture. That is our relationship. We are free individuals and we have made a deal. It's very exciting. Very exciting. We've done it. We didn't ask King Charles. We didn't. We didn't ask the Town Corporation, Beckley or wherever. We did it. And the necessity arises to do something about this, to enhance it, to make it work. Common law is a great device. It's and one of the great common law contracts, I think, as the Puritans took it, is marriage. Just think of that. Suddenly, in Puritan society in New England, two individuals free of one another agree to cohabit. Instant equality. Well, in theory.
Yeah.
Okay, almost. But it's very exciting. Civil unions were the rule in marriage in 17th century Massachusetts. And remarked a great increase, a great addition, a great advance in women's rights. Very few women took advantage of it legally because custom was still a strong drag. But they could sue for non-performance. Desertion. Cruelty. Because it wasn't part of the deal, guys. It wasn't our agreement. So the common law is really a very important innovation, a big change that's exported to the colonies and becomes the major, practically the only, legal experience of colonists. They don't have to mess with prerogative courts or civil courts or anything. They do in the colonies, they do common law, period. But it's already developed in England. It's not like a new American invention. Okay. Common law is very important. Also, in England, if you know anything, and I'm sure you do, about 16th, 17th, 18th century English political history, this is the time when Parliament begins to feel its oats. And indeed, the American colonists are eager witnesses to the rising power of Parliament. They think, that's a pretty good idea. We like that. We have our own little Parliament here. We think it's just like that Parliament in Westminster. Very productive of advances in the rights and powers of the subject and of their representatives in Parliament. So these growing economic and political freedoms find their theoretical expressions in two great philosophers of English politics and economics, British, I should add. England becomes Britain, said to myself. John Locke, Second Treatise of Government, Social Contract, great theorists of the Glorious Revolution of 1688, and Adam Smith, the great theorist of economic But, remember I said, why should your students be interested in colonial history? There are things in the mix, in the colonies, in the air. John Cotton once theorized it was the free air of the New World. That they could think differently than they did when they were in Old England. Things happened in the colonies, or as a necessary adjunct of colonial development, that strengthened colonists' conceptions of rights beyond the development of common law, beyond the development of colonial institutions. For one thing, the English colonies were to be colonies of agricultural settlement. They were to earn the bread by the sweat of their brow. It wasn't part of the original plan. The Virginia Company hoped that there'd be gold lying in the streets of Indian villages in the Chesapeake. Or failing gold and silver, they thought that there'd be so many Indians that wanted to wear English woolens that there would be a ready market for English manufacturers. And that's how they would make them. But those pipe dreams, intended pun because they found tobacco, those pipe dreams came to naught. English America, as it turned out, was not peopled by Incas and Aztecs and their mines of gold and silver, or by Asians with their spices, but with eastern woodland Indians, who lived well, suspiciously well, for people who lived wild. The English never quite figured out how they did it. But they didn't bring gold into the settlements. They didn't buy English woolens. And they didn't have enough furs to make a staple out of that, although it became an important part of trade. So England's colonies became colonies of agricultural settlement. And before the John Deere and the McCormick Reaper, we needed people to make those things work. And you want people of substance who can bring assets, other people, for instance, capital, trading connections, and you want people without substance who can work for those people and increase the productive capacity of the colonial society. People of substance and people who could labor. And English society developed far enough along the road to read them and write and so on and so forth. By 1600, that you couldn't make these people go. You couldn't say, you. Virginia. You had to entice them to go. Both people of substance and people who would dread only their land. So every colonial venture promised settlers substantial rights. I can't think of a single exception. I was thinking maybe last night the Providence Island Company was a possibility, but I don't think so, but it might have been. Important rights. Not yet, perhaps, Jefferson's expansive statement of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But rights. Valuable rights. Rights valuable enough to make you and you and you and me get up off our hindquarters and go. Either as an indentured servant or as a person who went and transported with him other indentured servants. What were these rights? colonists were promised again and again and again, and on the whole, it was a promise that was kept, that they would be governed by laws congruent with English law. They were promised again and again and again that whatever property they managed to acquire would be theirs by free and common socage, according to the manner of the tenor of the manor of East Greenwich. It's a language, almost every charter promises land tenure as in East Greenwich in England. Where English law was not appropriate or didn't work or people didn't know what it was, the colonists could make their own laws, either directly or through their representatives. And their free and absolute land tenure came with a guarantee of land. The headright system in Virginia, you might know of being West Virginians, 50 acres for every servant that you brought. And the servant themselves, in theory, got 50 acres head right when they had worked their terms of servitude. For English landless peasants, a considerable temptation. If they survived. Corporate colonies, which were modeled after English trading companies and English towns, like corporate colonies like Massachusetts, Virginia, Connecticut, Rhode Island, the first Virginia company, active participants in the colonial ventures were made freemen of the corporation, or the means to become freemen of the corporation were made clear, and they were made quite relatively easy. 13 shillings fourpence, a considerable sum, but I mean a significant sum, but not a great bar to people of some substance, bought you a freemanship in colonial Virginia. And all the privileges that went. So, this came along with these promises. One of the most significant because it has something to do with the Second Amendment, right to bear arms, was the promise everywhere, as far as I know, to free and fouling, which to ordinary English people accustomed to the death penalty for poaching on the lord of the manor's land, and there was no other place to hunt, no other place to fish. The right to free fishing and fowling was a considerable right, significant right. If you could fowl, you could also hunt deer. I'm sorry?
Trial by jury
was it's certainly written in the Massachusetts Charter. I can't testify that it was written into every charter, but I know it was in the Fundamental Constitutions of Carolina. So, yes, yeah, I'm sure that that's right. Even American geography was ignored. The realities, the possible realities of geography were ignored in this rush to promise rights. Every freeholder in Carolina, every freeholder, was promised direct access to navigable water. You can buy places in Florida. And the development of colonial economies Was on the whole successful. I mean, there were bad patches, bad periods. I try to read a new book every time I come to the West Virginia prison project. I've been reading a book called Building the Bay Column by an author called McWilliams, and I can't even remember the first name. James E. McWilliams. And even in this most inhospitable of American environments, thin, crabby, rocky soil of New England, these Puritan settlers figured out a way to create surplus wealth, to trade it with each other to their best mutual advantage through the mechanisms of the common law of contract, and create a remarkably prosperous society with a very vivid conception of their economic and political life. Vivid enough for Massachusetts to become, in that famous phrase, the cockpit of the American Revolution. Question? That's a really good question. Fishermen caused all kinds of problems in Puritan Massachusetts, partly because they were a pretty disorderly lot, and so they kind of offended Puritan sensibilities. You know what seafaring people are like. So that the town of Salem, in its first incarnation, 1629-1630, they drew up a covenant, a religious covenant among themselves, but I don't think any fishermen signed it, because fishermen were somebody else. One of the purposes of these early covenants was indeed the traditional purpose of excluding people who were not one of us. Now, one of the big questions in the development of American democracy is, who belongs to the club? Okay. More and more people belong to the club, but there are still exclusions. It's still a long story of struggle and conflict. Well, among the excluded people in 17th century Massachusetts was fishermen. And what Salem finally did, because of this problem of order, and at least partly a perception of these landlubber farmers, Puritans, who believed in the heart of hearts that fishermen were sinners, whether they were or not, they segregated them. Segregation was a great answer to your problem. So the fishermen were shunted down the coast to Marblehead. And Marblehead became a disorderly place by design, outside of the covenant of Salem. That's a good question.
That when these rights became incentives for people to go to the colonies, did you end up with a situation where citizens who went to the colonies had more right there than the citizens back in England? Did the colonies have that effect, or was England always up in front?
Well, that's an excellent question. My instinctive answer is the colonies were ahead. It's like the frontier thesis all over again. You know, was the frontier the engine of American democracy, or was Philadelphia? Right? A lot happening in the metropolis, that is to say, in the realm of England. A lot of progress that we would identify clearly as progress was happening, because that's where the action was. That's where the productive power was. That's where the money. I would say the colonists were, well, it depends on who you were. Indentured servants in Virginia had a hard time with it.
some of their complaints got back to the Crown and to the Privy Council. And they told their stories, and people were horrified. I mean, this happened to you, a freeborn Englishman? What's going on over there? So, you know, but on balance, I would say that. And clearly, by 1776, the Americans had acquired a very extensive conception of right that was well in advance of.
So when Jefferson said that they were self-evident, that's what he meant.
They saw them all around. They lived them. They knew that they were there. That's why I was signing letters from a federal farmer. Letters from an American farmer. Federal farmers didn't do it all together. Because this foreigner, this Frenchman, this Hector Saint-Jean de Crèvecoeur, who comes from Canada in the late 1750s, has already acquired what you might call the French vogue for America. He expects to see noble savages strutting up and down the streets. That's an overstatement. But he expects to find a new man in America because he's read about what America is like. I think that's clear from the text. And he does. He finds a remarkably free. You put those things together. It's very important. Freedom and prosperity go together. This is not—it's not a contradiction. It's not a conflict. It's freedom and prosperity are absolutely meaningless. Jefferson believes that you can't have a democracy. A democratic republic can't exist without that kind of widespread, not exactly economic homogeneity, but a kind of rough economy. Crèvecoeur says the same thing. That's what you have to have. He goes on to say, which I hope you'll read tonight in your spare time. He goes on to delineate several different aspects of this important equality, these important freedoms, and how they create a new person who's different from that Frenchman at home. A Hebridean. He finishes with an essay on Andrew the Hebridean, the Scotsman, who goes to America. He goes that terribly bleak. Anybody ever seen pictures of the Outer Hebrides? Wow. You know, they're nice and green. windswept, barren, plenty of sheep, but not all that many. Andrew the Hebridean lives in this savage place and goes to New York and becomes civilized. Simple as that. And de Crèvecoeur asked a question, really good question. Did this poor Englishman, this poor German, struggling in poverty, beholden to a landlord or a lord or a church, said, we call them Frenchmen or Germans or Scotsmen, but did they have a country? No, they did not. They've come to America and now they have a country. It's really a very important concept. So that's why I but then it's this American, this new man, this man is someone who has the conditions of freedom and the resources to do something about it. And he becomes a new person. By the way, he's a new man.
That obtains if you come to the more established colony.
Yes, indeed.
Can the exact opposite not happen if you press into the frontier?
Absolutely. He says exactly that. Did you read it?
No.
No. He has a very grim picture. The French. frontiersman is not the sort of person you'd like your daughter to marry, so to speak.
He kind of creates that whole Appalachian stereotype.
Pardon?
He's certainly creating that whole Appalachian stereotype.
Yeah, right, yeah. It's worse than hillbillies. I mean, good heavens. Your average hillbilly is a paragon of virtue compared to the predators from frontiersman. That's a really good point, because later in American history, of course, the frontier develops a kind of romance, a kind of, this is where American democracy, where individualism was born and all this sort of thing, characterized by none of it. He said a few frontiersmen survive and become civilized. And the rest he could care less about. They're savage. They're only a little bit better than savages. They're perhaps worse because they're European and they should not be quite as bad. There's a tinge of race.
If they prepare the ground for the future, right?
Well, he does concede that point. But they prepare the ground for the future, then they decently move away.
Right.
Except he says, my father was one of these people, but he became okay.
Well,
it did, yeah. I mean, it is that wonderful story of a new beginning. You too can quit smoking. any other questions? Well, I've given you the Predator's letter 3. What then is this American? Who is this guy? It's long, but it does, I think you'll see that in the text, there's plenty of it echoes or prefigured or whatever by what I've said tonight. And what we'll be talking about tomorrow from what time, Bill?
We start 8:30, 21.
8:30 from 8:30. We'll be talking about the problems of making that into a teachable resource. And if you judge it not possible, I'd be glad to hear that. I'm not searching for a particular answer. Okay? Other questions? What?
Yields.
Oh, bills.
Guilds.
Oh, guilds. Any guilds? Yes. Yeah, there were. It was as the point of shipbuilding industry matured, places like Philadelphia and London, you have shipbuilders. The most famous being the White Oaks of Philadelphia. They played a very important part in the Revolution and then again in the fabrication of transportation. And one of the interesting things about the colonies is the high cost of labor. In fact, that's an interesting feature of American economy at some time. That's one of the focus reasons for the America is a high wage economy. Very hard. They say, how are you going to keep down on the farm after they've seen Paris? Well, that was a World War I problem. The problem in 1750 was how are you going to keep them in city over when they have a chance to become their own freeholder in Lancaster County. The stability of labor is a big problem because everybody wants to farm. Everybody wants to have their own freehold property. It's the, I mean, Jefferson has, really, does. A certain amount of contempt for people who work for wages. What's wrong with somebody who works for wages from the point of view of a convinced democratic Republican? What's wrong with a person who works for wages? Well, they're not tilling the soil. Yeah. Farmers, there's that. Farmers are the children of God and so on. The salt of the earth. But there's a much more specific reason why, politically, laborers who work for several wages are not to be trusted. What's wrong with them?
They're not independent.
They're not independent. There may be free laborers, but they still are dependent on that, so to speak, that paycheck. And their boss, the Martin of the Fold. Well, it happened. It happened in the West Virginia Gold Field. So. So you've got these American prejudices coming out, too. It's not all. I think we're losing time. And we haven't mentioned slavery at all, really.
Fire up around 8:30, a little bit after. 8:30 on the day.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.